Hello, this is Jim Stein, your host today for New Books in Mathematics. Our guest today is Elie Mayor, who is a co-author of Beautiful Geometry. Beautiful Geometry is an exquisite coffee table book that merges the beauty of art with the beauty of mathematics. If your interest is in mathematics, you can come for the mathematics and you'll certainly stay for the art. But if it's the other way around, you can come for the art and we're going to try and talk you into staying for the mathematics. Elie is speaking to us today from Jerusalem. Elie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I just want to mention, you should also mention the co-author of that book, because it's a joint project of me, myself, and Eugen Jost, spelled J-O-S-T. Can I mention who he was? Is that okay?
Absolutely. Yeah.
He is a well-known Swiss artist who does wonderful artwork based on mathematical patterns and numerical sequences. And we bonded about 4 years ago and decided to cooperate on that project. So that's briefly the story of how the whole thing began.
Okay, that's not the story of how you got to where you are at the moment, because you told me the other day that you had retired after 53 years of teaching. So why don't you tell us a little something about yourself, your career, and then we'll start discussing geometry.
All right. I was born and raised in Israel and did my bachelor's degree at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and then my master's and PhD at the Technion, the Israeli Institute of Technology. And then I had to do something which is almost required unofficially of anyone pursuing an academic career in Israel. You have to spend a few years in the United States. There's a story.
2 degrees. Is that broadening or actually a formal requirement?
Well, it's not a formal requirement, but you better do it. There's a saying.
Well, we're glad to have you.
There's a saying here in this country that there are 2 degrees which are absolutely necessary for an academic degree. One, your PhD, and even more important, your GIA. Which is Yiddish for Gewisen in America. I was in America. So I had to show that I did that, fulfilled that requirement. And that was the worst time to apply for a job in the United States. It was like in the 1975, 76, where there was a deep recession in the academic world at the universities. And so I wrote to some 50 universities, all by a mechanical typewriter. It was before computers, right? Each letter had to be written again and again differently. And they all said, well, your resume is very impressive, but we cannot afford you any salary, or we don't have a space, and so on and so forth. Eventually, one university offered me half a position for 1 year, and I accepted. And that was the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire. I've never heard of Eau Claire. I barely heard of Wisconsin. So we pulled out. We have a pile of National Geographics. So we tried to find one with Wisconsin on the spine. And it so happened the very bottom one, at the bottom of that pile, had Wisconsin on it. So we pulled out the bottom volume, and the whole thing collapsed, of course. We opened at random. And what do we see? A bunch of guys with icicles from their eyebrows, sitting on a frozen lake, drilling a hole and doing ice fishing.
Not too much of that in Israel.
And go there. I'm not going with you. I'm staying there. So it was really something. Israel is a hot desert country, basically. And the only place you can see ice here usually is in your freezer, in your refrigerator. So to see these guys at a temperature of minus 40 or so was beyond belief. But we eventually made it and came there for 1 year. Then the 1 year extended into a second year and a third year. And before we knew it, we spent there 9 years and eventually moved on to Michigan and finally to Illinois, to Chicago, where I was teaching until a year and a half ago at Loyola University. I was teaching the history of math.
That's fascinating for several reasons. Number one is I'm a Chicagoan, or at least I was a Chicagoan for a long period of my life. And in addition to which, I went through exactly the same type of situation that you did, because I originally got a teaching position at UCLA in 1967. And in 1973, essentially the funding that had supported my position and a lot of other people's dried up. And I was in the same type of situation that you were. But fortunately, I was in the United States, and I was able to obtain a position at California State University, Long Beach, which was basically, although not in the same area code as UCLA, was 30-minute drive away. And so I was able to stay in California, where, incidentally, it is never too hot and never too cold. It's just right.
Yeah. In Israel, it's usually too hot.
Yeah, that's my impression.
Anyway, since we are chatting, I have to tell you, we came here, we are now, since I retired from teaching, we are splitting our time between Chicago and Jerusalem. And the day after we came to Jerusalem on December 10, the day after, there was a huge snowstorm here, like one that hasn't been seen here for decades. And the whole city was paralyzed for about 5 days. Because Jerusalem is not like Chicago. I mean, the roads are very narrow, and it's a very hilly city, and we are not geared to heavy snowfall. So we were basically stranded under house arrest for 5 days.
Yeah.
We knew about that storm from the internet before leaving Chicago. So we packed a few loaves of bread and some necessities to survive here for a few days, and it helped us. Otherwise, we would have had survived.
Well, you wouldn't have had to worry about water, because when snow melts, that's what it forms.
Well, after that storm, we haven't had a drop of rain for the next 6 weeks, which is bad, because this country needs a lot of rain, and we didn't have any. So after that single snowstorm, the winter here is really more like springtime.
Well, I don't know whether or not you're talking about Israel or the United States, because in California, we need a lot of rain, too, and we're not getting it. But on the other hand, on the East Coast, they're getting a tremendous amount of it. And it's interesting, because all these tie in with geometry, because it's the geometry of the sphere plus the motion of the cloud systems, the weather patterns, etc., which are a form of geometry, which dictates the weather that we experience. But I think that's way beyond what Euclid was looking at. Anyway, it is quite uncommon to find a book that combines mathematics and art. Beautiful Geometry is just that. It's an art book based on geometric patterns. I know you described that you and Eugen Jost got together and wrote this, but who had the idea?
Well, the idea came to me, but I have to give Eugen equal credit. Can I tell you in a word how we met? Would that be okay?
Be delighted. Be delighted. This is your show, Ellie.
Right. We, about 4 years, in 2010, I think it was 2010, I was invited to give a talk to the upper high school math class of the cantonal high school in Aarau, Switzerland. Now, Switzerland has 20 or so cantons, which are like states in the United States. And Aarau is a town about midway between Zurich and Basel. And their high school has some claim for fame, because young Einstein, when he was 16 years old, spent there 2 years, his happiest years in up until that point in his life. And the same building that he attended, where he attended school, still exists. They had some additions, but the basically same school. And there is a lot about Einstein there, several plaques and a bust of him. And it was really interesting. The town really became famous because of that. So we were received, my wife and I, with great honors. And at lunchtime, there were a few guests, and among them was Eugen Jost. I have known about him before, but never met him. So we instantly bonded, and we share many, many things, even though we are separated by, 4,000 miles of of ocean. But he and I love geometric patterns. He lives in patterns. His whole life is centers around patterns. Whenever he sees some pattern, whether it's in architecture or in nature or in some math design, he immediately gets some idea to make of it a piece of art. And he has done wonderful things, both by hand and on his computer. And then we share a second thing, which is even more important, a good sense of humor. In a project like that, that helps a lot. We often teased each other and criticized each other, all in good spirit, and no one got offended, and that worked to our advantage. So that's how we got to know each other.
I think that's anytime I see collaboration, especially between two areas that you think are so disparate, it's always a pleasure because they're both aspects of the human intellect and human creativity. And I think that in doing things like this, to a certain extent, you're helping foster a bridge between what C.P. Snow described as the two cultures, because I think it's true that scientists appreciate art more than artists appreciate science and mathematics. And anything that can be done to make artists appreciate science and mathematics a little more, such as a book like Beautiful Geometry, I think it's a wonderful thing to do.
You are absolutely correct. That affinity between art and math, and even more between music and math. So often you hear stories about how music and math are so much related. But unfortunately, that relationship, that affinity, goes mainly one way. Mathematicians appreciating art and music, but very seldom the other way around. And that's not to say anything against the art community, but that's a fact of life, that the appreciation usually goes one way, I have to say.
Yeah, I've noticed that, I've noticed that too, but it's interesting when you talk to, I've seen studies about this with elementary school children. When you ask them what their favorite topic is in school, when they're very young, they say arithmetic. And by the time that they reach seventh or eighth grade, at least in the United States, if you ask them what their least favorite subject is, it's arithmetic. So somewhere along the line, we're doing something that's sadly wrong, because what's happened is that we've managed to kill enthusiasm for something that is intriguing. Because I taught, you taught history of mathematics for a long time. For a long time, I taught mathematics for elementary school teachers. And I think that one of the most important things that you can do is whenever you see enthusiasm in a child for something, you want to kindle it. You don't want to squelch it. Yeah. And it's just sort of unfortunate that whatever we're doing in education is obviously not promoting the real interest in arithmetic and geometry that both you and I feel there should be.
Well, I tell you, it takes, I think, two things. First of all, you need to have a good teacher, an inspiring teacher, and there is no shortage of those. But also, you have to pick up the right subject. I mean, arithmetic can be interesting. For instance, I did some research on children's perception of infinity. And infinity is not an easy subject, but amazingly, even 4 or 5 year old kids have already an appreciation of infinity, something which goes on forever, like a road never terminating or railroad tracks seeming to meet at the horizon, but actually don't meet. So they meet at infinity. And what's the largest number you can reach to? And before you know it, at the age of 5, they already know that there is no largest number. So it would have been nice to take these subjects which really trigger their imagination and develop those subjects. So instead, we do all the boring things of multiplication table and so on and so forth, long division, which are important, but they're not very inspiring. And I'll be honest, I also hated them in grade school. So,
well, we differ a little there because I absolutely love them. But that's probably an indication that I was fated to become a mathematician. But I remember I used to go around thinking that every time I saw the 27, every time I saw a baseball player batting 286, I knew he was batting 2 for 7 on the average. I just love numbers. But not everybody does, but everybody loves patterns. Everybody finds patterns beautiful. And that I gather that you wrote the mathematical portions and Eugen produced the graphics. Did you collaborate on the graphics? Did you offer suggestions? Or did you just say to Eugen, well, here's an interesting geometrical result one way or another. And then Eugen went off into a corner and came up with, hey, what do you think of this?
Well, actually, it was like a two-way process. When we first started to collaborate on that project, we wondered, should we have some guidelines? And it soon became clear that we cannot have strict guidelines to go by, because geometry has hundreds, maybe thousands of theorems. Each one of, or many, many, many of them are very beautiful and could be a chapter in our book. But that didn't work. So eventually we settled on, whenever he had some pattern or some theorem that he loved, and he knows a lot of math, even though he is an artist, but he knows a lot of math. He made a drawing of his own, and then I decided, would that be a proper theorem to discuss in our book, and if I liked it, and if I thought it can be explained in a simple way, I said, yes, let's do that. In other cases, I suggested to him some theorem and asked him if he could come up with some creative design based on it. So it was a totally mutual process of give and take, and it worked. It really worked.
Yes, it certainly did. And I think that you went about it the right way, because I think it's a lot easier for a mathematician to support art than it is for an artist to support mathematics, simply because the literature in mathematics and the amount of mathematics that has been produced probably greatly dwarfs the amount of art, and you have much more to call upon. And I'd like to, you know, I'd like to discuss at this moment a couple of the early chapters in the book. Yes. Because there are two theorems that that I think are known to virtually every one of our audience, and you basically start off the book with them. And the first was Thales of Miletus, and I've always been a big Thales of Miletus fan for a reason that was not in your book. He was, of course, a great geometer, and I knew that he had constructed the theorem about vertical angles being equal, and I also knew that he was the first person to come up with a prediction of an eclipse of the sun. But what I did not know was the fact that he was the one who discovered that in a circle, if you draw a diameter and then take a point on the circumference and draw line segments from the ends of the diameter to the specific point on the circumference, that the angle subtended was a right angle.
Right.
I did not know that Thales was responsible for that.
Well, at least that's what tradition says. You know, we don't have any hard evidence of any of those early Greek mathematicians. Not much survived of their writing, if any. And so that all we know about him and then Pythagoras and so on came by later historians who sometimes lived 100, 200, 300 years later and based their writings on word of mouth, on tradition. So everything we know about Thales should be taken with a grain of salt. But allegedly, he was the one who proved that theorem. And he was the first of the long line of Greek philosophers who asked why and not just how. For instance, why does the diameter divide a circle into two equal halves? Now, that might seem like a trivial question, but he wanted to understand why. So we don't know how he proved it. but at least he was the first one to wanted to know why things happen, why things work as they are, and not just how to solve a given problem.
One of the things that impressed me about the book, as soon as I opened it, some of the graphics were absolutely just spot on, I felt. And the graphic accompanying Thales of Miletus, which I'm going to try and describe to our audience, and I hope that the description is accurate, but it's one of the things that made me wish that this were a video conference so I could just flash that on the screen. But it consists of nine separate squares in a 3x3 arrangement. And what you see looks like a sun rising. It's a yellow circle on basically a dark horizon. And you see the yellow circle rise to the point where finally the sun has risen and it's just over the horizon and the sun is tangent to the horizon.
Yes.
But what made the graphics so spectacular for me is the way that several theorems were incorporated here. Because one of the things that you do is you mention a theorem, which I don't know whether this was known to Thales, but you mentioned that what the diameter does is, I think the word is subtends a right angle on the circumference. But any chord subtends exactly the same angle, no matter what point on the circumference you choose, as long as you either choose it on the major arc, the longer arc of the circle, or the shorter arc of the circle. And what's brilliant about the picture is that when you see the sun rising to the point where it's less than halfway up, Eugen drew two sets of angles for each picture, and they're exactly the same. The ones that are set there, you can see that the angular measure is the same, even though they're on different sides of the sun.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, and he did that both above and below the horizon. And then when he got to the point where it was 90 degrees, he drew a bunch of different right triangles subtended both above and below the horizon. Just an inspired graphic. Well, I thought this was brilliant.
It was Eugen's brilliant idea to draw that. And but then I gave it the name Sunrise over Miletus. That was my name.
and you know, the interesting thing is, had you just mentioned Sunrise over Miletus, because Thales, as I say, is responsible for the first prediction of the eclipse of the sun. I fell in love with the book as soon as I saw that picture. And then you mentioned that you and Eugen often went back and forth on an issue. I won't say that I had a bone to pick with the Pythagorean theorem, because how can you pick a bone with what I think is the greatest theorem in mathematics? I don't know whether you feel the same way, but I think that's the greatest theorem in mathematics.
Well, I'm a little bit biased because I just wrote like 6-7 years ago a book on the Pythagorean theorem, so I'm not exactly objective about that subject. But yes, it is certainly the most famous, or let's say most well-known theorem in all of math. I mean, you ask any person on the street if he or she remembers anything from high school geometry, and if at all, they will mention the Pythagorean theorem.
Go ahead.
On t-shirts. Now, that's the universal bulletin board, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, what I was about to say for the Pythagorean theorem is, I always tell my students that in order to celebrate the discovery of the Pythagorean theorem, Pythagoras ordered 100 oxen to be barbecued. And I said that sets a measure of how important a theorem is. And I said, if you take the other two theorems that I think are the co-runners for the second most important theorem, I'd say the fundamental theorem of arithmetic, which says that every number can be factored uniquely into primes, mm-hmm. and the fundamental theorem of calculus, which we won't go into, but is an absolutely spectacular one. But they're only worth about 60, barbecuing about 60 oxen for. And when you take my production, I think my greatest theorem is probably worth one side of oxen ribs.
Well, let me interrupt you here for a minute, if I may. That sure. story about the 100 oxen is repeated many, many times, and I think it's a little bit apocryphal. I doubt if that was true, because the Pythagoreans, the schools founded by Pythagoras, were a sect that abhorred slaughter of any kind, human killing and killing of animals. So they thought that they sacrificed 100 oxen to celebrate the theorem. It makes a nice story, but there is a lot of doubt if that actually, to be honest, I was about to write that in the book, and then one of the reviewers who went through the manuscript said, don't write it, and I listened to him, and I think he was right.
You know something? You want to keep that story simply because it's such a great story, even if it isn't historically accurate. Sometimes what you have to do is you have to sacrifice historical accuracy in the interests of drama and art.
There's a difference between telling that story orally to an audience and writing it in a book, because what you write is permanent, you know, and then it can be held against you. So
you could always say, you know, what do you...
Science, like the Newton and the falling apple, there's absolutely no evidence that that actually happened. Newton...
But there's no evidence that it didn't.
That's true. But so in archaeology, there's a saying, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
I think they use that, you know, they use that in more than archaeology. Anyway, let me get into the plate that accompanies the Pythagorean theorem, because maybe you can give me some insight into why this plate was chosen. And then I'm going to describe one which I think you will immediately recognize, and it's the one that I would have chosen. But the plate that is used, Eugen has a graphic of what looks to be a right triangle,
yes,
but it really isn't, because it's the hypotenuse has 49 squares on it. It's a 7x7 high. The hypotenuse is of length 7, and each side is of length 5. And as we know, 5 squared is 25. 25 plus 25 is 50, which is not equal to 7 squared, which is 49.
Right.
And he has one square over on the side. And perhaps you could tell me exactly what this represents and why it was so chosen, because it was a little confusing to me.
You mean what that illustration represents?
Yeah, if you have an insight into what Eugen was thinking at the time.
It's a piece of humor.
Okay.
It's a piece. If you read the introduction, the preface, and as I told you, both of us have a good sense of humor. We like to poke fun and to tease. And it's basically teasing. There is some twist there, which I don't know even what the twist is, and that probably is a secret that Eugen will not share with anyone. But he made it look like it should be the Pythagorean theorem, but at some point there is some little twist that makes 25 plus 25 equal 49 rather than 50. So the whole thing was meant as a poking fun. One reviewer, I have to tell you, he criticized that illustration just like you did, and he said it might confuse the reader. But we decided to overrule him, or maybe her, I don't know. They didn't leave a name. Because we wanted to be a little bit whimsical. We wanted to break the rigidity of most math books. You know, math books can be so... Well, sometimes boring because I'll be honest, boring because they are so technical, and you really have to have an enormous amount of concentration to follow. We wanted to be a little bit on the light side, to have a little bit fun. So, and there is a quote there by an American artist by the name. Escape me right now. It will come to me in a minute. Who said that in math, 2 plus 2 is always 4, but in art it can be 5 or 6 or anything. Joseph Albers, that's his name, Albers.
Oh, okay, Joseph Albers. I was actually going to mention Joseph Albers at some stage, because there are two artists who are well known for their love of the square. One is Piet Mondrian, who, you know, produced a whole series of paintings entitled Homage to the Square.
Right.
But Joseph Albers has a number of they're graphics of some sort, but what they are is they are squares inside of squares, and the colors, you know, there are color gradations. variations in them. Maybe they go from yellow to sort of light brown, or maybe they go from rose to a darker color of red. But they're visually very appealing, and they're all based on geometry. And you know, everybody knows that there's a lot of appeal in geometry. But I would like to. I would like to comment on what you called Eugen's whimsy, because there's a fairly well-known picture puzzle, and I can't exactly recall its name, but it's the same type of thing. It looks like, you know, it looks like the count of the number of squares is correct, but it isn't. It's missing one.
Yeah, well, and, yeah, there is a lot of those. I mean, that's not unique. I mean, there is it's hard to describe in words. You have to see it visually. But there are several well-known books on like math puzzles where there is some kind of a paradox which is difficult to detect where the flaw is. So it's we still liked it, you know.
I can't blame you, but I have to put in a plug for what I consider absolutely the loveliest proof of the Pythagorean theorem, or at least the simplest one that I know, which I'm sure you're familiar with. If you consider the Pythagorean theorem to be a squared plus b squared equals c squared, what you do is you just draw a large square of side a plus b. You mark off a division point on each line of length A on each of the four sides of the square, and then you connect them and you get a square inside of side C, and you can see immediately just from the algebra, knowing that A plus B quantity squared is A squared plus 2AB plus B squared, that you know the Pythagorean theorem falls right out. And I must admit, that's the picture that I would have used.
You mean, just to make what you said a little bit more visual, a square inside which there is a smaller tilted square.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
Square. Well, that proof is actually known as the Chinese proof, because there is some evidence the Chinese already knew it, maybe even before Pythagoras. But Euclid did not accept that proof. He would not have approved that proof, because that proof, in a way, is a physical proof, in a way. It depends on moving the side triangles, the triangles at the side of between the small and big square, moving them around to make them overlap each other, which is a physical operation. And Euclid insisted on that everything should be done by pure logic, proved by pure logic, and not in reference to any physical process. So even though that proof is perhaps the simplest of all the 400 or so proofs of the Pythagorean theorem. By the way, there is a website where you can post your own proof and they will show it. And if you have a nice color, the diagram, they will show it. There are again and again supposedly new proofs of that theorem. For some reason, that theorem has attracted more proofs than any other theorem. And so that proof that you mentioned is perhaps the simplest one, but it is not totally in the spirit of Euclid. Euclid's proof actually is a very, not an easy one, a very complicated one, but that still is regarded as the classical proof of the theorem.
Oh, I remember. I sat through that classic proof when I was in high school, and boy, was that a struggle. The one where I think everybody's seen it, the one where you draw a square on the hypotenuse and then drop down and then it involves rectangles, and it was just a bunch of work. But one of the things that you mentioned actually touched on another question that I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned that Euclid would not allow this particular proof because it was physical in nature. I wouldn't have said that. What I would have said, it was algebraic in nature. Because when you see the proof given to you in a book, it's usually given as a mixture of geometry and algebra.
Yes.
And what they do is they say, you know, in order to appreciate the proof, you need to know the algebraic expansion that that A plus B quantity squared is A squared plus 2AB plus B squared. And then the rest of the proof is basically algebraic manipulations, which I don't think Euclid would have objected to, because this is one thing that I don't know as much about geometry as I should. As I remember, geometry consisted of what you might call geometric postulates, such as a point is that which has no part, and between any two points there exists one and only one line. But it also has relationships, such as things equal to each other are equal, things equal to a third object are equal to themselves, yes. And things such as equals added to equals are equal. And those sort of strike me not so much geometry, more in the line of algebra. And I'm wondering what Euclid would have thought of, you've already told me he would have rejected this proof for physical reasons, but would have he have rejected it also because maybe it touched too much on algebra, and of course they didn't know algebra at that time.
Well, actually they did know some algebra, except not in the form that we know it today. Today, to us, algebra is like a language of symbols. Symbols and x, y means x times y, and so forth. The Greeks knew some algebra, but it was all a geometric kind of algebra. The formula you just mentioned, a plus b squared equals a squared plus 2ab plus b squared, they knew that formula, and it can be proved purely on a geometric, in a geometric way, by taking a square and dissecting it into, again, I need to show it to you on a blackboard, which I don't have now. But dissecting a square into two smaller squares and two rectangles, congruent rectangles, and you show that these rectangles have areas AB and BA in that order, AB and BA. But because these rectangles are congruent, therefore AB equals BA, and you have the formula as we know it. That was a geometric proof, which, if I'm not mistaken, actually appears in Euclid. Likewise, A squared minus B squared equals A plus B times A minus B, etc. They knew some algebra, but it was not a workable algebra like ours today. Today we use algebra as a tool. For them, these relations were mainly geometric relations among areas, among shapes. And that might be one reason why he did not use that proof. I didn't have the pleasure of meeting Euclid, and we don't even know who exactly he was. Nothing about him is known for fact. So we can only speculate what went through his mind. We just don't know. But what the proof that we have, actually there are two proofs in Euclid, the one that's mentioned in my book, and in book 6 of Euclid there is a second proof, which is more dependent on congruent triangles. So he offered two proofs, quite different ones. Why he didn't offer the so-called Chinese proof, we can only speculate.
Yeah, you know, one of the things also, when I was looking at your book, not every topic in your book is what I would consider to be pure Euclidean geometry. Some of it is extensions of geometry that were found later. And for instance, you have such things as the snowflake curve. I remember first being acquainted with the snowflake curve. I can't recall where I first saw it, but the snowflake curve is something that's tremendously attractive. Yeah. And again, it's one of those things that it's difficult to describe. That it's difficult to describe if you're just doing audio, but one of the things that I would say to anyone who's listening to your show, to this show, pick up a copy of the book, because the book is just beautiful. And I'd like to go into a couple of other topics that aren't so much related to pure mathematics as they are to the book. It must have occurred to Eugen at some stage that maybe the plates that he has produced for the book, I would imagine that they're plates that there are original somewhere which were reproduced for the book, they'd make a good exhibit at an art show. Has he considered doing that? Do you happen to know?
You mean an exhibit of Eugen's work?
I'm sure he's done exhibits of his work, but exhibits specifically of the plates that were used in this book.
Well, I know that there are many mathematical exhibits worldwide, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if some of these theorems have been shown in museums. I mean, that's not unusual. Is that what you were asking? Not exactly.
There are 51 plates. Maybe there are more in this book. I always thought, I didn't read it cover to cover counting everything. But basically, even though there are ancillary diagrams in some of the chapters, mm-hmm. each chapter features a specific plate by Eugen. Am I correct about that?
Yes, well, actually, sometimes more than one. There are about 60, over 60 color plates, yes.
Okay, so there are 60 color plates. Has he considered an exhibit of just those 60 colored plates?
Oh, just those. Okay, I must have missed a word in your original question. Well, no, we haven't, and that's actually up to Eugen, because he, after all, he's the artist who did those. I know that he had several, he's quite well known in Switzerland and in Germany and France and Europe. He has had several successful exhibits. You know what? I will, with your permission, I will suggest that to him.
You have my permission to do anything you want whatsoever, but I would like you to do the following. If he does decide on such an exhibition, tell him to send it to Los Angeles so I can look at it.
Okay.
Okay, because I would love to, you know, I've been to several of my relatives are involved in one way or the other with art. I don't know how that happened. The genes went wrong somewhere. I can't exactly describe it. But anyway, I've been to a lot of exhibits that I have to, you know, that I sort of have to restrain myself from sarcastic and snide comments, because after all, these are my relatives or friends of mine. And I'd love to go to an art exhibit where I could just look at every single piece and say, you know, I absolutely love that. And the only time that ever happened is when I just looked at an exhibit of Monet's water lilies, and that's all it consisted of. Mm. But I know that if I just saw these 60 plates as an exhibit, I'd be a really happy camper.
You know what? It's actually an excellent idea, wonderful idea. I will mention it to him right now after our interview. I will send him an email and suggest that to him, and who knows?
And you might tell him also that 60 plates is 5 times 12, and those are two numbers in a Pythagorean triple, 5, 12, and 13. So he's probably well aware of that. There are a couple of other specific topics in the book that definitely, you know, when I saw them, they struck my fancy for different reasons. There are instances in which you go, in which you go a little beyond what would ordinarily be considered geometry, and that's perfectly fine. For instance, everybody loves the Fibonacci numbers, and the Fibonacci numbers lead into the golden ratio, so which is, of course, a classic example of the Greek integration of art with geometry. So I like the idea of the Fibonacci numbers, but the idea of beyond infinity, which I think beyond infinity is the last chapter in the book.
Yes, it is. And you, I suppose you are asking me, what does that have to do with geometry, right?
Well, I know that the one-to-one proof that's typically given, for instance, you can show that any real line segment is in one-to-one correspondence with the points of any other real line segment, and you do that by means of the diagram in the book. But that didn't really strike me as pure geometry. This is more on the lines of set theory with George Cantor.
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, you know, there is, again, no clear-cut dividing line between geometry and things which are close to geometry. Let's just say all the plates, or almost all the plates, are geometric in nature. And therefore, we thought here once in a while, here and there, we will also include some numerical sequence or number pattern if it can be illustrated in some nice geometric way. And by the way, the frontispiece of that book, I don't know if you saw it, is a picture in beautiful blue called Infinity, like a square inside a square inside a square, but tilted relative to each other, a little bit like Joseph Albers, what you as you described. But
he lines up his squares.
Right.
All the squares are parallel.
Right. No, here they are not. They are tilted relative to each other. It's the frontispiece, which is a beautiful picture. He actually gave us, my wife and I, a signed copy of that that print.
Oh, lovely.
And we are framing it and putting it here in Jerusalem in our little apartment. And so it is, in a way, geometry. We didn't want to put a rigid, like artificial dividing line between geometry and other branches. Like you said, the Greeks already knew, had some algebra. Euclid, the book, the 13 elements of Euclid, 13 elements of Euclid include some algebra in a geometric garb. So we felt that these divisions are, should not be regarded as rigidly as they are often described, you know.
Incidentally, you included some of my absolute favorite curves, and I want to thank you for that. You included epicycloids and hypocycloids and cycloids, and I'm a huge fan of them. And I must admit, one of the things that I think one of the pleasures and advantages of doing mathematics nowadays is I can remember when I was, you know, when I took courses in mathematics, doing such things as sketching parametric equations or polar coordinates, yeah. Working out these graphs were tremendously difficult. And now they've got, you know, you can go to any number of websites where you can stick in your own parametric curve and they will dynamically plot it for you so you see it unfold. And when you see the epicycloids and the hypocycloids trace out, it's just lovely.
Yeah,
it's
I have to.
It's wonderful.
If I may. That
sure.
is absolutely true. With a grapher today, $70 or $80 grapher, you can do infinitely many designs. But there is also some of the old magic gone, because in the older days there were mechanical tools that would do that job, and you could actually see what's happening. Like not so many years ago, like 20, 30 years ago, there was a favorite popular game called the Spirograph. I'm sure you.
Oh, I remember Spirographs. Oh yes, lovely.
And I incidentally, just before leaving Chicago, I saw it in a puzzle store in a new edition. So apparently, it didn't lose any of its popularity. A set of toothed wheels or cog wheels, and you engage them and put a pencil inside, and you could create an almost infinite variety of different cycloids, hypocycloids, epicycloids, you name it, and you could actually see and feel with your own hand what's happening, which of course you cannot with the computer. So some of the old magic is gone with the electronic age. But that's,
you know, something, you're absolutely right. There are any number of things that we've lost, but I'd have to feel that, you know, I have to feel that we've gained more than we've lost. Because, for instance, I just think it's wonderful. You and I probably would never have met. And we probably, you know, there's a chance that, well, I go to Chicago occasionally. I'm there every 5 years for my high school reunion. Maybe our paths will cross then. But I think it's just so wonderful to have something like the internet available where you and I can. You really are in Jerusalem at this moment, right?
Yes. Otherwise.
Oh, okay.
you mentioned something to me when we spoke last. There was a bad connection last week, remember? And you said, well, maybe in Jerusalem the speed of light is less than... I love
it. Well, the person who was at that... just a couple of other things. One of the things that I certainly want to ask you about is, do you have any projects on the horizon that you would be interested in telling our listeners about?
Well, truth be told, yes, I do. But I learned in life not to brag about unfinished business. So let's just...
Okay, well, I learned something called the arithmetic of projects, which this may be something that I've learned, that one idea in development plus three half-finished projects equals no projects.
You bet. You said it. So there are some projects and in various stages of development, but Maybe we'll talk about them next year, a year from today.
Ellie, whenever, you know, if you do something, please be sure to get in touch with me, because not only have I enjoyed this conversation, and I'm sure our listeners have as well, but once again, let me recommend to all our listeners, go out and take a look at beautiful geometry, because beautiful geometry is really rare. It's not just math. It's not just art. It's not just somebody put math next to art. It's a fusion of the two, and I really recommend it. Ellie, it's been a pleasure, and thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Being,
it was
being
to
here
talk
today.
To you. All the best, and we'll keep in touch.
We sure will. Okay. Best wishes, Ellie.
Take care. Thank you.